he had served as an expert consultant in epidemiology for several world bodies, including IARC and the World Trade Organization, WTO. In 1999, Infante was chosen as one of four epidemiologists to advise the WTO during its deliberations on the European Union's ban of chrysotile asbestos. But CropLife told the EPA that the chemical industry players it represented feared Infante would disregard industry-funded studies in favor of independent research. They said he showed bias in the past against the industry and had testified in a past court case against Monsanto. He had to go, CropLife said. The EPA caved. 2 days after the agency received the October 12, 2016 CropLife letter asking for Infante's ouster, the EPA said it was halting the meetings that were to have run from October 18 to October 21. The EPA refused to acknowledge that the move was due to industry arm-twisting and said the change was due to scheduling conflicts. It also said it needed to find additional epidemiology expertise. Oddly, no one told Infante he was off the panel. Weeks went by in which Infante continued to receive SAP documents from the EPA and was led to believe he was still to be part of the scientific team. But when the EPA finally announced in November that it was rescheduling the meetings for December, Infante's name was missing from the SAP roster of experts. Infante was confused. He had not been notified of his exclusion until the day before the rescheduled dates were announced. The appearance of industry influence was obvious, but the agency did its best to deflect publicity around Infante's dismissal, hinting that he had simply become unavailable to serve on the panel and refusing to discuss the decision in detail with reporters. Infante, who lives in the Virginia suburbs within a short drive of the EPA offices, was outraged at the agency's actions. He had served as an expert on an unrelated scientific panel only a year prior for the EPA without issue. Can you think of one other chemical that has more impact, economic and other, than glyphosate? That's why I'm not on the panel. Monsanto didn't want me on there, and they figured out a way to get me off, he said. Monsanto and others in the agrochemical industry elite often act like bullies, according to Infante. If scientists have a lot of integrity, then they try to destroy them, he said. We live in a society of risks, and in a free society, a person should be able to make an informed choice based on knowledge of the risks. But the industry tries to obscure the knowledge. How can the public even hope to get independent scientific findings? When the EPA held the SAP meetings in mid-December 2016, Infante showed up anyway. Before being removed from the panel, he had spent countless hours going through the research, and he wanted to make sure his observations were heard. He asked the EPA to allow him to speak during the public comments portion of the meeting and was told he could have 10 minutes. He dressed conservatively for the occasion, in a dark suit and shirt, but added a splashy bright orange and silver tie. He made no mention of his treatment by the EPA when delivering his public remarks, and focused only on what he said were significant findings in the epidemiology data. Looking every bit the professor with his manicured gray goatee, wire-rimmed glasses, and a somewhat unruly mound of thinning curls atop his head, Infante commanded rapt attention from the other scientists as he conveyed his analysis. His conclusion, he told the other panel members, was impressive evidence of ties between NHL and glyphosate. He told the group that the epidemiological data showed that glyphosate should be considered a likely human carcinogen. There is clearly the evidence for the risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma related to glyphosate exposure, Infante said. Is it conclusive? No, I don't think so. But I think that EPA is concluding that there is no evidence, and that's exactly wrong. Several members of the scientific advisory panel had their own concerns about the EPA's dismissive view of some of the data showing links to cancer, and they said as much during the public meetings. Some scientists said they were concerned that the EPA was violating its own guidelines in discounting data from various studies that show positive associations between glyphosate and cancer. And some questioned why the EPA excluded some data that showed statistical significance and wrote off some of the positive findings to mere chance. Monique Perron, a scientist in the Health Effects Division of the EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs, tried to explain away the concerns, telling the assembled scientists that professional judgment played a role in looking at the weight of evidence from various studies. Still, panel member Leanne Shepherd, assistant chair in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington School of Public Health, said there was enough epidemiological evidence linking glyphosate to NHL to support a suggestive causal connection. Individually, the studies may not contain strong evidence of a connection between glyphosate exposure and NHL, but when looked at together, they do, she said. Clearly, it's suggestive to me, and it's the most appropriate public health conclusion to reach, she said. Panelist Kenneth Bortier, a statistician with the American Cancer Society and brother to IARC advisor Christopher Bortier, noted the split between the scientists on how to weigh the research. Rarely does a panel disagree as much as this one, Portier said. Aside from the discussions of the science, some onlookers questioned whether the EPA gave non-industry experts fair time. During what the EPA deemed the public comments part of the agenda, Monsanto representatives were granted roughly 3.5 hours to argue their case for glyphosate safety, and several other agrochemical industry players were allowed lengthy presentations as well. In comparison, most critics of glyphosate had comment periods that ranged from 5 to 15 minutes. EPA spokesman Stephen Knott said that assignments of speaking allotments were based on how much time commentators asked for, but some glyphosate opponents said they were told they could not have more than a few minutes. Monsanto used its time to present a defense of glyphosate's value to agriculture, to offer detailed explanations for why IARC's analysis was flawed, and to explain why the company believed that a host of data points found in various studies should be discounted or are not relevant. Company representatives also argued that glyphosate residues found in numerous urine tests were nothing to worry about, and actually helped show that the chemical does not bioaccumulate in the human body. They also said reports of glyphosate residues found in human breast milk were implausible. Any doubts the EPA or its scientific advisors might have had about how much attention the public was paying to the meetings disappeared as several members of consumer and environmental groups showed up to implore the EPA to restrict or ban the chemical. Kathy Bloom, a concerned mother from Leesburg, Virginia, and a member of the Moms Across America group, was one of the first to take the microphone, her voice rising as she made her plea. Glyphosate is everywhere. It's in our air, our water, our soil, our food, our beverages. It's in mother's breast milk, she told the panel. Children are exposed to glyphosate in many areas, playgrounds, parks, ball fields, and their own backyards. Glyphosate has been found in tap water, our children's urine. Any amount of glyphosate is unacceptable. By allowing glyphosate-based herbicides to be sprayed on our food and feed crops, you are allowing America to be poisoned through our food and water. All of us are guinea pigs in this horrendous toxic experiment. You have an opportunity now to stop this. Our lives depend on it. A poignant moment also came when Alexis Baden-Mayer, a lawyer with the Organic Consumers Association, read aloud letters to the EPA written by people blaming Roundup for lymphomas that struck them or their family members. One letter was written by Vicky Laybourne, whose husband, Paul, died of central nervous system lymphoma after years of exposure to Roundup. Vicky and Paul had been married for 43 years and were happily settling into semi-retirement when Paul became sick. Vicky, who lives in Smithville, Missouri, couldn't attend the EPA meetings in person, but she wanted the EPA to know what her family went through when the cancer was found in Paul's brain and he died in September 2012. I wasn't aware how widespread this was, she told me. These companies need to be held accountable. The EPA meetings even drew theatrics as a New York-based activist known as the Reverend Billy Talon, who leads a group of self-proclaimed earth-loving urban activists, took his turn at the microphone. accompanied by fellow activist Robin Laverne Wilson, who goes by the moniker Dragonfly. Talon told the EPA and scientific advisors that his group had created a national map of parks and playgrounds where glyphosate is used to aid parents who want to avoid exposure to the chemical. "There is a political cloud hanging over this room, this proceeding," he said. Clad in a minister's dark robe and white collar, Talon told the EPA and scientists that they should pull the curtain back and expose the political pressure that Monsanto applies to keep glyphosate on the market. "We ask you to free yourself from this tremendous prejudice that has kept this toxin in so many of our homes, in our bodies, in our food, in our air." When Talon and his group exhausted their allotted 5 minutes, they launched into song, repeating a solemn hymn-like refrain, "Monsanto is the devil, no glyphosate." When the meeting was over, panel members wrote a final report to the EPA that said they could not fully agree with the EPA's view of glyphosate safety. While some agreed that evidence of carcinogenicity was lacking, other panel members felt the research did suggest a potential for glyphosate to affect cancer incidence. And the group agreed with many critics who said that the EPA was improperly discounting the findings of some studies. Many of the arguments put forth by the EPA as supporting glyphosate safety are not persuasive, panel members concluded. As of this writing, however, the EPA has done nothing to rein in the use of glyphosate, and its final risk assessment, initially due out in 2015, is still pending. The EPA's actions are particularly vexing to many who believe the agency is relying on outdated, industry-funded research and undue industry guidance in making its determinations, and they fear the public is suffering for it. "Glyphosate is a very effective herbicide, but it should be extremely restricted," said Terry Vrain, a soil biologist and genetic scientist who spent 30 years working for Canada's National Agricultural Department. "The stupidity of having it in the crops is madness, and the level of exposure to people is unacceptable. The residues in the food are probably responsible for a lot more damage to humans than anything else." Vrain did not come easily to his criticism. In fact, he was a longtime defender of technological advances in agriculture. During graduate school in North Carolina in the 1970s, Vrain learned all about the wide range of pests and pathogens that can lay ruin to a critical crop, so he was particularly enthusiastic when genetically engineered crops were introduced that could resist harmful pests, and he held faith that the biotech companies would do as they promised and develop disease-resistant crops as well. All he really knew about the Roundup herbicide that so many farmers were using with these GMOs and other crops was that Roundup was supposed to be the best thing on earth, Vrain recalls. "It was wonderful," everyone said. When Vrain retired from the agricultural department in June 2003, he had so much time on his hands that he took up gardening and started learning more about organic agriculture. He began to examine how the prevalent use of Roundup might be more perilous than many people suspected. Vrain pored over scientific journals and obscure studies examining glyphosate, and what he found disturbed him so much that he pushed aside the relaxation of retirement to take on an activist's role, working to convince Canadian and U.S. regulators of what he sees as serious human and environmental hazards. "Regulators have simply become too entwined with corporate interests to be objective about the high-dollar products pushed by the powerful chemical industry," Vrain believes. "Everybody can be influenced," he said. "Corporations have a lot of money, and they know how to work the system." Chapter 6. Spinning the Science. For every scientist who raises a concern about a product, there seems to be a corporation to contradict him, or her. We've seen this happen again and again. Tobacco industry executives famously hid research done by their own scientists that showed the hazards of cigarettes, and they misled lawmakers and regulators about the addictive properties of nicotine. Many other corporate powers, including those in the agrochemical industry, have long histories of defending themselves against claims that they covered up the dangers of injury from asbestos, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, Agent Orange, or other chemicals. DuPont has spent the past several years in an ongoing battle against more than 3,000 lawsuits alleging the company knew that a chemical called perfluorooctanoic acid, commonly known as PFOA, could cause disease but hid that knowledge for decades, even as its PFOA contaminated West Virginia water supplies. And Dow AgroSciences spent years fighting mightily to stop the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, from banning an insecticide tied to brain damage in children. Like any corporation, Monsanto Company does not shy away from zealously using its money, power, and political sway to promote its products and defend them against criticism. That is to be expected. But with Monsanto and its allies in the agrochemical industry, the propaganda playbook has many different chapters, and some are intentionally hard to read. A common tactic is to funnel industry messaging through individuals who appear to be independent of industry and who carry a gloss of expertise and acclaim that gives them credibility with consumers, lawmakers, and regulators. These experts appear unaffiliated with industry and thus unbiased. What the public doesn't know is that behind the scenes, corporations are often funding and collaborating closely with these very same professors and other professionals who tout propaganda that serves industry interests. It's all part of a strategy of spin that has been used by the tobacco industry, the soft drink industry, pharmaceuticals, and, of course, agriculture. These closeted collaborations make it difficult for consumers to know whom to trust and what to believe. And the rule appears to be the less transparent, the better. Several examples have come to light only because of records obtained through Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests and investigations by journalists and consumer and environmental groups. What the records clearly show is a roster of U.S. academics, people employed by taxpayer-funded institutions, quietly working with Monsanto, other agrochemical companies, and public relations experts to tout the benefits of company products, to counter anything that points to problems with glyphosate or glyphosate-tolerant crops, and to cripple unfavorable legislation or regulation. The ties to the industry are typically not disclosed, as these people sell the story the corporations want told. One example of the hidden corporate hand at work dates back to 2013, when Monsanto wanted to procure policy briefs supportive of the company's interests that appeared to be unaffiliated with the company. The plan was laid out by Monsanto's Chief of Global Scientific Affairs, Eric Sachs, in an email to 9 prominent academics, including a professor at the prestigious Harvard Kennedy School. Sachs told the professors he hoped each would help with an initiative to promote the safety and benefits of genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and he assigned each a topic and background materials. Harvard professor Calestous Juma was asked to write an article laying out the consequences of rejecting GM crops. Each brief should be about 4 to 6 pages in length and include key themes and messages related to the specific topic, recommendations, and a call to action, aimed at a broad audience that included policymakers and regulators, Sachs told the professors. The key to success is participation by all of you, recognized experts and leaders with the knowledge, reputation, and communication experience needed to communicate authoritatively to the target groups. You represent an elite group whose credibility will be strengthened by working together. You are the best possible messengers, Sachs wrote. Sachs told the group that an organization called the American Council on Science and Health would run the project in partnership with a public relations consulting group. The plan was for the two organizations to coordinate the publishing and promotion of the articles, setting up speaking engagements, webinars, and other events. Sachs said he was aware that the professors' reputations must be protected, and that Monsanto wants the authors to communicate freely without involvement by Monsanto. By December 2014, the articles Monsanto had asked for were circulating, though without any mention that they came at Monsanto's behest. Juma's article hewed closely to Monsanto's suggestions. The connections came to light only when the email communications were obtained through FOIA requests from the consumer advocacy group U.S. Right to Know and reported by several news outlets. For his part, Juma told the Boston Globe that he may have used bad judgment, but didn't intend to hide Monsanto's ties. He received no money for the work and was true to his own views, he said. Another prime example of hidden alliances has come to be known as the Seralini affair. Gilles Eric Seralini was a professor of molecular biology at the University of Caen, Normandy, when he published a study in September 2012 in a scientific journal called Food and Chemical Toxicology, FCT, about the effects of Roundup herbicide and Roundup Ready corn on 200 rats. Publication in a journal such as FCT requires a lengthy process in which experts unrelated to the study review it and can ask questions and seek revisions before it is published. This peer review process is meant to curb publication of flawed research. Seralini had spent 2 years and more than $3 million working with seven other scientists to study how the genetically modified corn and the herbicide impacted the animal's health. At the time, Seralini was also president of a scientific advisory board that worked with a group opposed to GMOs. He believed there were potential problems with GMOs and Roundup that had not yet been uncovered by the scientific research that was largely funded by the chemical industry. Seralini and his team had seen troubling results in previous studies, including evidence that Roundup herbicides containing POEA, along with glyphosate, were much more harmful than glyphosate alone, causing cell damage at levels expected to be found in food. Groups of rats were evaluated by the Seralini team in the 2012 study. The rats were divided into males and females. Some were fed genetically engineered corn, others consumed corn sprayed in the field with Roundup. The others were given Roundup and drinking water in different doses, with the lowest corresponding to levels found in some tap water. The intermediate dose was set at the maximum level permitted in the United States in animal feed, and the highest dose was correlated to half the strength of Roundup as used in agriculture. Control group rats were fed a diet containing non-genetically engineered corn and plain drinking water. The Seralini study results were alarming. Treated rats had much higher death rates than the control group animals, and the exposed rats demonstrated an unexpected increase in tumor incidence, especially mammary tumors in female rats, along with damage to the animals' livers and kidneys. But scientists said both the GMO corn and Roundup contributed to the health problems that developed in the experimental animals, and they said they found unexpected low-dose toxicity from Roundup at levels 10,000 times lower than those permitted in drinking water in the United States. The study results clearly indicate that lower levels of complete agricultural G, glyphosate, herbicide formulations, at concentrations well below officially set safety limits, can induce severe hormone-dependent mammary, hepatic, and kidney disturbances, the study authors concluded. Seralini said his research gave credence to fears that Roundup contains ingredients more toxic than glyphosate and that Roundup formulations should be considered endocrine disruptors. News outlets around the world published stories about the study findings, and regulators in many countries were understandably rattled. France's prime minister at the time, Jean-Marc Ayrault, said that the country would consider a ban on GMO corn sprayed with glyphosate, and the European Commission said it would seek a review by the European Food Safety Authority. Russia temporarily suspended importing glyphosate-tolerant corn, and Kenya actually moved to ban all GMO crops, most of which were sprayed directly with glyphosate. The announcement of the study results came at a particularly bad time for Monsanto, just 2 months before California residents were slated to vote on whether or not to require labeling of foods made with GMOs, an issue Monsanto adamantly opposed. Glyphosate residue on foods was one of the concerns that drove the labeling efforts, not just in California, but in several other states as well. So any bad news about glyphosate's impacts on health was a big problem. Just as they had done with other negative research reports, and not unlike the attack they would later launch against the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, Monsanto and associated industry players railed against the Seralini study, telling journalists it was fatally flawed in many ways. The European Federation of Biotechnology Industry Association, which counts Monsanto and other agribusiness firms among its members, called for the paper to be retracted, saying it reflected a dangerous failure of the peer review system. Other organizations and ultimately regulatory bodies weighed in, mimicking Monsanto's claims that the research was flawed and not to be believed. California voters narrowly rejected the mandatory GMO labeling bill as the attacks on Seralini continued for well over a year, and scientists around the world debated the perceived merits and shortcomings of the Seralini work. About 130 scientists, scholars, and activists took Seralini's side, weighing in with support in an open letter published in Independent Science News. The group noted the industry pressure on scientists whose findings were unfavorable and said the backlash against Seralini's study raised the profile of fundamental challenges faced by science in a world increasingly dominated by corporate influence. And then Richard Goodman stepped in. Goodman, a trim, bookish-looking man who favored a neatly kept mustache and held a doctorate in dairy science, worked for Monsanto from 1997 to 2004. But by the fall of 2012, when the Seralini study was published, Goodman was working at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Records would reveal that despite his work at the public university, Goodman was still tightly entwined with Monsanto, relying on funding from the company and other agrochemical interests to run a food allergy research program at the University of Nebraska. In that role, he was happily touting the safety of agricultural biotechnology, training scientists from other countries in how to evaluate the safety of GMO crops that are sprayed with glyphosate, and issuing reports about how GMO crops, engineered to be sprayed with glyphosate or to repel pests, were not likely to trigger allergic reactions in people. And though Goodman's job description listed him as a faculty member of the university's Department of Food, Science, and Technology, it was the funding from Monsanto and other agrochemical and seed companies, such as Bayer, DuPont, and Syngenta, that kept Goodman afloat. A look at the sponsorship agreement for the allergen database for 2013 showed that each of six sponsoring companies was to pay roughly $51,000 for a total budget of $308,154 for that year. Goodman was also collaborating with Monsanto on efforts to turn back mandatory GMO labeling efforts and mitigate GMO safety concerns, and was offered media training by the agribusinesses. Records would reveal that roughly half of Goodman's income came through industry funding. When the Seralini study broke, Goodman was quickly in contact with Monsanto officials and eager to help in the response. Documents again obtained by U.S. Right to Know show that on the day the Seralini study was published, September 19, 2012, Goodman was emailing Monsanto toxicologist Bruce Hammond shortly before 10 a.m., asking for talking points or bullet analysis that Goodman could use in discussing the study. By November, Goodman was doing much more. He was acting as associate editor of the FCT Scientific Journal, the very one that had just published the Seralini study and from which Monsanto was seeking a retraction. Goodman was placed in a role overseeing GMO-related research reports. It's not clear if Monsanto had a hand in getting Goodman appointed, but emails do show a direct connection between Monsanto's Hammond, Goodman, and FCT's editor-in-chief, A. Wallace Hayes. Shortly after Goodman was named associate editor, Hayes told Hammond that he and Goodman were aware of the criticism of the Seralini paper and wanted Hammond and other critics to act as reviewers for the journal. Around the same time Goodman was signing on to FCT, He was also worrying about whether the industry money would keep flowing. In emails, he expressed concern about protecting his income stream as a soft money professor. In late 2013, after Goodman had been on the journal's editorial team for roughly a year, FCT abruptly retracted the Seralini study, saying it had decided the data were inconclusive and the conclusions unreliable. Critics were quick to link the retraction to Goodman, but he denied any involvement. Seralini saw a clear connection, however. In a statement defending his work, he declared the retraction the result of pressure from the GMO and agrochemical industry to force acceptance of GMOs and Roundup. Goodman's appointment to the editorial team was a most flagrant illustration of agrobusiness's influence and underscored how industry's tight hold on what was considered acceptable science puts public health at risk, he said. This episode illustrated the vulnerable position of dependent science and the economic and political forces that move to defend Roundup and Roundup contaminated crops, Seralini said. The Seralini study was republished in another journal, Environmental Sciences Europe, in June 2014. Still, the heavy industry criticism left Seralini's credibility deeply scarred. Goodman's affiliation with Monsanto was underscored by communications related to a second study, the Sri Lanka work that tied glyphosate to kidney disease. Emails obtained show Goodman asked Monsanto's Food Safety Scientific Affairs lead, John Vicini, in October 2014, for help evaluating what he called an anti-paper. Goodman said he needed someone at Monsanto to provide him with some sound scientific arguments for how to view the study's findings. Monsanto actively campaigned to discredit the study, saying there was no evidence whatsoever that glyphosate contributes to kidney failure in humans or animals. Another professor with close but largely hidden ties to Monsanto, who also called for a retraction of the Seralini study, is former University of Illinois food science professor Bruce Chassie. Prior to his retirement in 2012, Chassie touted a stellar academic reputation and decades of experience earned at the public university and as a researcher at the National Institutes of Health. He has been an avid supporter of GMOs and glyphosate and an unforgiving critic of biotech detractors. He has traveled the country and the world, giving speeches, making presentations, and working to convince regulators that independent academics, such as himself, view GMOs and glyphosate herbicides as perfectly safe. Through it all, he has proclaimed himself free from corporate control. But Chassie's veil of independence appeared quite thin when internal emails revealed multiple professional and financial links to Monsanto. In one arrangement, Monsanto helped set Chassie up to run a website called Academics Review, which was designed to counter scientists, journalists, activists, and others who criticized GMOs and agrochemicals such as glyphosate. There was only one catch. Monsanto wanted to keep its involvement a secret. In a November 2010 email laying out the plan, a period in which Chassie was still working at the university, Monsanto's chief of global scientific affairs, Eric Sachs, wrote to Chassie. From my perspective, the problem is one of expert engagement, and that could be solved by paying experts to provide responses. The key will be keeping Monsanto in the background so as not to harm the credibility of the information. In that same exchange, Sachs told Chassie that Monsanto had just sent a gift of $10,000 to his university, so the funds should be there. Jay Byrne, president of the V. Fluence public relations firm and former head of corporate communications for Monsanto, told Chassie in a separate 2010 email exchange that he was trying to move the Academics Review project forward and that he had a list of industry critics ready for Academics Review to target. He suggested, "We work on the money for all of us." He told Chassie that the topic areas mean money for a range of well-heeled corporations. Chassie did not disappoint. Under his hand, the Academics Review site published several critical articles about individuals and organizations whose work did not support industry objectives, including the IARC working group that classified glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. No disclosure was made of Monsanto's interests in or support of the website as it came out with the critical articles. But a look at tax filings makes the connections clear. Money was funneled through a nonprofit set up by the industry called the Council for Biotechnology Information, CBI, a group that states in government filings its goal is to promote agricultural plant biotechnology through the exchange of information about its benefits. CBI directors included Phil Miller, Global Regulatory Affairs Vice President for Monsanto, as well as Dow's Global Affairs Leader, Brad Sherdit, and DuPont's Jerry Flint, also a Vice President for Regulatory Affairs. Academics Review received $300,000 from the CBI in 2014 and $350,000 in 2015, the records show. That was only a small portion of the millions of dollars the group spread around annually for education, advocacy, and other means to groups in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. In addition to the website, Chassis helped Monsanto in many other ways. He co-authored a long article about Seralini, calling the study fraudulent and saying the work raised questions of scientific misconduct. Several emails from 2011 show that Chassis and Monsanto's SACs, along with others in the industry, discussed ways to lobby the EPA against expanded regulation of biotech crops. And in a September 2011 email exchange with people from Monsanto and industry, Chassis suggested how the biotech crop industry might spin a government report that found significant levels of glyphosate in air and water samples. Chassis referred to anti-GM chemophobes and told the group the take-home message should be the mere presence of a chemical in an ecosystem or ecological niche is by itself meaningless. The antis always conveniently forget this. Chassis even traveled overseas to do Monsanto's bidding, in at least one case agreeing to a mission before he understood its objective, as seen in this excerpt from a January 2012 email from Chassis to Sachs. "You originally asked if I would go to China and do what I did in Korea. You wanted to know if I was available and said you would explain later. One thing led to another, and I am now going, but we never did speak about the actual mission on China. Where am I speaking? To whom? For how long? More importantly, what is the topic and is there an assigned title? What's really going on and what are the between-the-lines issues? Knowing the answers to all these questions would really help me plan a talk. Can we talk sometime before I start putting a talk together?" In other exchanges, Chassis, Sachs, and Monsanto's John Swarthout, who led the company's scientific outreach and issues management, discussed what Chassis' China presentation should say, including changes made by Monsanto. Sachs instructed Swarthout to send slide decks to Chassis as material for him to use. Monsanto's Hammond also asked Chassis for help creating short videos about the safety of GM crops. In those email exchanges, Chassis said he thought he could use university equipment to do the work and asked Hammond for a list of videos that you think would be helpful. Chassis also was a regular contributor to an industry-funded promotional website called GMO Answers, where he wrote that research linking glyphosate to illnesses was flawed, again failing to disclose his ties to Monsanto. At the same time that some of this was going on, Monsanto money was flowing in Chassis' direction. It's unclear exactly how much money was involved, but several emails discussed financial payments. In one, Chassis told colleagues at the university that Monsanto had promised him the company was going to make a substantial contribution to his biotech account at the university. In a different email exchange, Chassis asks Sachs about a contribution for the University Foundation Biotech Fund. The Monsanto executive responded that he would make a gift to the foundation right away, if it had not already been made. Chassis said the check should be accompanied by a letter saying the check is an unrestricted gift in support of the biotechnology outreach and education activities of Professor Bruce M. Chassis. Chassis didn't disclose the financial relationships publicly. Instead, The payments were funneled through the University of Illinois Foundation, which does not have to report its funding, keeping the payments out of the public eye. Chassie said he did nothing unethical or improper in his work supporting Monsanto and the biotech crop industry. He said he was never asked to modify his independent views and was never compensated in any way for his expertise. Financial support from the private sector for public sector research, education, and public outreach is not only appropriate, Chassie said, but needed. As a public sector research scientist, it was expected that I collaborate with and solicit the engagement of those working in my field of expertise, Chassie stated on the Academics Review website in September 2015, the same month his relationship with Monsanto was revealed in an article in the New York Times. Monsanto also said there was nothing improper about the arrangement, but critics have argued the public is being misled by these types of covert connections. These revelations regarding the connections are very important, said George Kimbrell, senior attorney with the Center for Food Safety, a nonprofit consumer advocacy group. The basic disclosure that some academics and other neutral commentators in the public sphere are actually paid operatives slash working directly with the chemical industry rightly alarms the public, as they are being misled. Another U.S. professor who became a member of the inner circle of Monsanto academic allies was Kevin Folta of the University of Florida. Folta, who holds a doctorate in molecular biology, was known as a strawberry expert, having helped lead a project to sequence the strawberry genome from 2007 to 2010. But Folta became a favored friend for Monsanto and its public relations team around 2013, as they looked for people to help them combat GMO labeling efforts. Folta was eager and willing to assure the public that GMO crops were healthy and that glyphosate residues were not harmful. Documents obtained by U.S. Right to Know revealed a series of arrangements between Monsanto and Folta to help Monsanto on its PR mission. In one email, Folta told Monsanto he was glad to sign on to whatever you like, or write whatever you like. In fact, Folta was one of the nine professors Monsanto asked to write a policy brief in 2013. His assignment? To provide examples of activist campaigns that spread false information that goes unchallenged. Folta was supposed to push a narrative that critics of GMO crops were undermining worldwide efforts to ensure a safe, nutritious, plentiful, and affordable food supply using responsible and sustainable agricultural practices. Folta did as asked, the records show. Folta was then, and as is of this writing, associate professor and chairman of the Horticultural Sciences Department at the university, so his credentials carry a lot of weight. A top executive with the Ketchum public relations firm made it clear how important Folta's work for the industry was, writing to him in May 2014. Professors, researchers, scientists have a big white hat in this debate and support in their states, from politicians to producers. Keep it up. Part of Folta's work with the industry included the use of his name and likeness on a pro-industry website called GMO Answers, funded by Monsanto, Dow, and other agrochemical and seed companies. Ketchum designed the site as a Q&A forum where academics such as Folta would appear to be relying on their expertise to address frequently asked questions about GMOs and agrochemicals. Ketchum said in one email to Folta that the website was a new way to build trust, dialogue, and support for biotech and agriculture. But while the website stated that the answers came from Folta, they were actually written, at least in some cases, by the PR firm. Here's just one example of suggested text the PR firm wrote to post on the GMO Answers website attributed to Folta. In the wild, the transfer of genes within and across species is fairly common, either through traditional reproduction, breeding, or through non-traditional means. Viruses and bacteria do this all the time, as do plants and animals. Human DNA, for instance, is full of viral genes. The PR executive told Folta he was free to revise and use his own words. But in the public posting on the industry website, underneath a picture of a smiling Folta, not a word was changed. When IARC's classification and glyphosate's probable carcinogenicity hit the news, Folta was cited by GMO Answers as an expert on the issue, with a column under his name declaring glyphosate as amazingly non-toxic to humans or any other animals. In all, Folta was cited as an expert on the corporate-run website more than 70 times from 2013 through 2015, all of this while he ostensibly was working for a taxpayer-funded public university. The agrochemical and seed industry players were also paying for Folta to travel, make speeches, and give industry-friendly presentations. In August 2014, Monsanto agreed to provide an unrestricted grant of $25,000 for Folta to travel to several universities to train faculty, staff, and students about GMO agriculture. But again, keeping the ties a secret was part of the plan. Folta suggested that Monsanto send its money to a program within the nonprofit University of Florida Foundation that would allow the funding to be hidden from public scrutiny. The program was known as Special Help for Agricultural Research and Education, or SHARE. If funded directly to the program as a SHARE contribution, essentially unrestricted funds, it is not in a conflict of interest account. In other words, SHARE contributions are not publicly noted, Folta told Monsanto. This eliminates the potential concern of the funding organization influencing the message. After the New York Times revealed Folta's arrangements with Monsanto, the university and Folta came under heavy public criticism, and the university announced that the $25,000 was reallocated to a Florida food pantry. Folta defended his work with Monsanto, saying the controversy was built on manufactured narratives. "I had an established, effective program that a company wanted to support," Folta said in a statement posted by the university. "Science can benefit from corporate partnerships to foster efforts of scientific literacy, and that helps all of us." Folta continues to be an active advocate for Monsanto and its products, including glyphosate, and routinely makes written attacks on journalists, scientists, and others who point to research that doesn't align with industry interests. He's criticized me on social media forums and in blog posts, writing that I am a hideous human and disgusting. In one of a series of emails Folta wrote to me, he said that I was a liar and manipulator. He also told me that he made disclosures about his ties to industry to the level required, and says he acknowledged it when it was relevant. Even though he asserts he has done nothing wrong, Folta says that being caught in the public spotlight the way he was has taken a toll on his professional and emotional well-being. Folta said he has lost numerous opportunities because of the reports about his industry ties. "My hair started going gray, and I aged a decade. My breathing is slow and shallow, and I don't sleep well. I'm forgetful. The toll has been harsh. My eyes swell with tears when I even think about what I have been through," he wrote on his website. The agricultural industry has cheered him on, awarding him the Borlaug Cast Communication Award in 2016, a designation to recognize those who demonstrate a passionate interest in communicating the importance of agriculture to policymakers, the news media, and the public. Gary Ruskin, co-director of U.S. Right to Know, said that the pattern of corporate influence over American academics discovered by his nonprofit group is alarming, because the hidden collaborations are aimed at papering over the health risks of products such as glyphosate. "Supposedly unbiased scientists have been degraded into corporate PR flacks," he said. Another favored strategy for the chemical industry has been to stake out spaces on social media, a vast internet-based landscape where virtually anyone can blog or tweet or comment on any topic under the sun. Who would think that glyphosate would have its own Twitter account, for instance? But it does, with a long stream of positive messages about the agrochemical, with no disclosure as to who the account belongs to. Glyphosate is perhaps the world's first pesticide to have over 1,900 followers on a mainstream social media platform where politicians, celebrities, and anyone else with a message to share can meet. Glyphosate's Twitter account was established in March 2015, the month IARC made its carcinogenic classification. PR experts inside and outside Monsanto have also sought out bloggers to post articles that support GMOs and glyphosate on different consumer and health websites, including the popular WebMD, where readers turn for information on a range of health and nutrition topics. Mommy bloggers, women who write about parenting or related topics, are among the social media players Monsanto and its PR teams have recruited for positive commentary on agrochemical industry interests such as glyphosate and GMOs. Monsanto has ties to social media groups such as hashtag moms for GMOs and science moms, for instance. These groups post favorable industry information on an array of websites while appearing to be independent of industry influence. Academics were also asked to write favorable blogs on WebMD without mentioning a Monsanto connection. Monsanto government affairs lead Lisa Drake laid it out for Volta in a January 2015 email exchange. After wishing him a Happy New Year, Drake asked Volta to submit a blog on the safety and health of biotech to WebMD. She provided him with instructions on how to submit an article and asked him to be sure to insert the word labeling somewhere in the content in order to get search algorithms to pick it up. She underscored how hard Monsanto was working to get favorable content published. Over the past 6 months, we have worked hard through third parties to insert fresh and current material on WebMD's website. Volta replied within a few minutes, "Can do, my pleasure." Anna Lappe, co-founder of the nonprofit Small Planet Institute, calls the tactics stealth marketing techniques that work surreptitiously to shape public opinion. In an opinion piece she authored on the topic, Lappe said this, "Sure, PR is an old game, but Big Ag is giving the age-old techniques of shaping public opinion a new, sneakier spin. Much of today's marketing happens behind the scenes and off the printed page, on the web pages of blogs, on Twitter feeds and Facebook pages, through sponsored content and industry-funded webisodes, and on the stages of Big Ideas festivals. There are, in fact, small armies of industry promoters spread across social media, trolling for negative commentary and responding to any they find with fast retorts that back industry interests. Sometimes the connections between these social media players and certain corporations are clear-cut, sometimes not. But the social media circles have been growing in power and influence. Court documents state that one such strategy by Monsanto, called Let Nothing Go, is designed to monitor social media postings and respond to any critical comments or articles about industry interests. The Center for Food Safety found out just how powerful the social media strategy could be when the organization scheduled a presentation in Honolulu, Hawaii, by author, activist, and Monsanto critic Vani Hari, who markets herself as Food Babe. Event organizers slated the presentation for September 2016 and offered free tickets to the public, but asked that people who wanted to attend RSVP so they could be guaranteed a seat. In an effort to sabotage the event, a pro-Monsanto group that refers to itself as March Against Myths About Modification put out a social media call for help. The group asked Facebook followers to make large numbers of fake reservations so the event would appear sold out, but would actually leave Hari speaking to a nearly empty hall. Leaders encouraged people to use fake names and create disposable email addresses, even providing instructions on how to do so, to reserve the seats. More than 1,500 tickets were reserved this way under names like Harriet Tubman, Fraud Babe, and Susie Cream Cheese. Facebook postings showed scores of people from around the world making fake reservations and joking about the deceit. Organizers uncovered the scheme the day before the event and were able to cancel many of the fake reservations, opening up seats for valid reservations. Hari said the events were jarring. "I chose to put my focus and energy on the willing, the people who want to hear about what's really in their food and how they can make healthy changes to their lifestyle. On the other hand, there are some serious detractors that do not want the truth about our food to be heard. They are working as agents for the biotech and chemical industry to prevent information about the risks of using chemicals like glyphosate that are coupled with GMOs to come to light. The March Against Myths group is just one of various organizations created, funded, or otherwise backed by agribusiness to tout its messages. In some cases, the links to industry are clear, while in other cases, they are harder to see. These front groups act essentially as echo chambers, citing each other as sources that reinforce industry positions with the veneer of expertise and impartiality. Their names often sound impressive and authoritative. Take, for instance, the American Council on Science and Health, ACSH, the group Monsanto positioned to help it promote the policy briefs by Fulta, Juma, and the other academics. The ACSH was founded in 1978 and bills itself as a national nonprofit education organization that supports evidence-based science and medicine. It does not publicly disclose the range of corporate funding it relies on, but records obtained by journalists in 2013 reveal a money trail that leads to a number of chemical companies as well as prominent food and tobacco companies. The group has been a vocal supporter of glyphosate, calling questions about its safety ridiculous fear-mongering. The ACSH, not coincidentally, uses its website to promote the March Against Myths group, which tried to sabotage Hari's speech, and to attack people who raise questions about glyphosate's safety. The group wrote and featured a piece on its website accusing a New York Times reporter of lying when he authored an article about glyphosate concerns. Fulta and other industry supporters similarly interfered with a speech planned for early 2016 in Houston by Terry Vrain, a Canadian molecular biologist who has raised concerns about glyphosate and GMOs. Vrain was to deliver a lecture at the Houston Museum of National Science entitled "The Poison in Our Food Supply." A few days beforehand, a storm of emails, phone calls, and social media messages, along with a blog piece written by Fulta, assailed the museum for hosting the event, claiming Vrain lacked credibility. Many accused Vrain of practicing junk science and threatened to cancel their museum membership if it didn't axe the lecture. The museum president succumbed to the pressure and canceled the event. Organizers were able to find an alternative venue nearby, and the evening lecture was held anyway, but the power of the industry cheerleaders was clear. In fact, there are many industry-backed organizations that often coordinate with the companies and their public relations arms to try to sway public opinion and push for favorable public policies. And, like the ACSH, they sound quite impressive. There is the International Life Sciences Institute, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, and the Alliance to Feed the Future. Records show the organizations all have receiving funding from Monsanto and numerous other food or chemical companies or corporate-funded trade groups. Monsanto created a group called America's Farmers out of whole cloth, and it formed and funded a group of dietitians specifically to communicate with consumers who have questions about food and agriculture. Called Leaders Engaged in Advancing Dialogue, LEAD, the organization is made up of registered dietitians around the country who receive talking points from Monsanto and participate in events the company lines up. They are active both on the ground and across social media, protecting industry interests. And in a very targeted move, a group called Campaign for Accuracy in Public Health Research was launched in early 2017, specifically to tear down the credibility of IARC for having classified glyphosate as possibly carcinogenic. The group, which called itself an education and outreach initiative, declared its first mission was to reform IARC and bring to light the deficiencies, misinformation, and consequences of IARC's findings. And just who was behind this new group that aims to promote credible, unbiased, and transparent science? None other than the American Chemistry Council, whose membership includes the agrochemical industry heavyweights Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, and Bayer. The industry hides behind such friendly-sounding organizations, according to public health attorney Michelle Simon, who wrote a detailed report in 2013 on industry front group activity. The idea is to